Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, Dr. Patricia Timmerman Barbarossa da Silva. Dr. Pat is a psychotherapist, author, and founder of Advocate to Create. In her book, Why Are We Fighting?, she introduces the IAP model, intention, action, perception, a Google Translate for communication. With over 12 years of experience, she specializes in grief, trauma, and couples therapy, integrating research-backed strategies to improve relationships. She also provides clinical evaluations for immigration cases, combining her mental health expertise with her background in immigration law. Dr. Pat, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's a pleasure having you on the program today.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And we have to give another shout out. I seem like I do this regularly on the podcast, to Noemi Barris, who introduced us. She is a wonderful podcast agent, has a knack for really matching the right guest contributors to the right podcast, and it has led us to this point today.
Oh, I agree. As you said before, she's a great matchmaker.
Yes, she is. And today we're going to be talking about a topic that I think needs to be addressed more in and of itself, suicide grief. But before we get into that, I do have a preliminary question to ask you. And Dr. Pat, I'd like you to tell our listeners about the experiences that have shaped your current life path and your life passions today.
Oof, well, that is a loaded question. It's funny, like life throws curveballs and you never really know where you're going to go. Right. And the reason I say that is I'm a psychotherapist, right? Licensed mental health and licensed marriage and family therapist. But when I was at NYU, I had my pre-med. That was my focus and my major was whatever. So I remember I did intro to psychology and intro to political science. And when I did that, I said no to psychology and my major was political science. And I really did enjoy politics a lot. It's funny how it goes from present to past tense, huh? Mm-hmm. And I did not know my life was going to take me here. And I actually fell in love with the mind. Because I remember when I did my master's in mental health and marriage and family therapy, I was looking more into teaching. Because I've always loved teaching. And it just, I saw the major, the curriculum at Barry University, and it kind of spoke to me. And I was doing my master's because I wasn't ready to go to medical school yet. So I was going to do my master's and then continue to medical school. And I finished my master's and I started studying for the MCAT. And as I was talking to like the different instructors for the MCAT, I started realizing like I'm in love with the mind. Like I think I incorporate a lot of the physiology and understanding the brain because our body and our minds are intertwined, the physicality and the psychology. But it kind of took a detour and led me here.
Yeah, that is an interesting path. And, you know, I know for me, when I started out and went to college, I wanted to be a phlebotomist, believe it or not. And I took that position because as somebody coming out of high school, my guidance counselor said, you know, you want a position that's going to help you get a good job down the road. I found out that I didn't really like talking to test tubes as much as I like talking to people. And I took a child psychology course with a guy by the name of Dr. Richard Denberg at Utica University. It was then Utica College. He inspired me so much that I changed my major. And that led me to one of the career path that I eventually embraced with addictions. and that eventually led to other opportunities as well. But, you know, when we start out going down one path, the universe sometimes has different plans and a plan that's much better than the one that we had originally.
Yeah, because I would assume you may be similar to me when I say what I'm going to say. So you tell me just based on your description. But I have the gift of loving what I do.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so do I. And if you love what you do, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Damn. I agree. I mean, there's always things attached to it. All the progress notes, all the clinical notations, and that part of the job is not necessarily what I love, but the one-on-ones. I'll share really quickly. Have you heard of Dr. John DeBotch?
Offhand, no.
No, he has a podcast as well that's called A Relationship Revival, and he identifies as Mr. Spirituality. But he and his wife wrote this book called Your Apology Sucks, which is great. For couples. But the reason I'm bringing him up is he once was, when we were talking, he was saying, you know, love, your source of love needs to not be human because humans are limited. And he was expressing to me, like, I'm a rabbi, my source of love is my spirituality. Immediately when I thought of my husband, I was like, oh my God, his source of love is jujitsu. When he's doing it, you can see it gives him that energy. And it dawned on me, like, my source of love is therapy. And my husband will always tell, whenever I am in a frustrated space, I will go into a session or I'll go into teaching a class and I come out much better. Because it's that, right? It's loving what you do.
Exactly. And it's essentially for me, I could do without the case notes. I could do without the administrative oversight. And it was essentially working one-on-one with individuals who were misunderstood, who were stigmatized because of their addiction. And my job was to help them see the inherent beauty in themselves so they could transcend that addiction.
I take my hat off to you. And I have to say, for all the people listening to your podcast, if you don't already revere this man, please do. Because I think there's such a beauty in working with addiction. It's not my area of expertise. And I think working with children, you need to know your niche. You need to know your limitations and your abilities. And I take my hat off to you because addiction is... There's so much I know we're going to touch upon suicide, and I just coming from sessions related to suicide grief, and I was just telling them, I'm like, there's so little that we know about the psychology of suicidal ideation. Not everybody who dies by suicide or attempts struggles with depression or struggles with addiction. Some are preventable, some are not. Some are unplanned and like just a reaction to something, and some are not. So there's so many different variables that are unknown. And I think similarly with addiction, there's so much that we still don't know. So we're trying to, just to be able to help and seeing the beauty in it. Yeah.
And we need to, because individuals are more than their addiction, and individuals who have contemplated suicide that's not the culmination of their life story. It's one part of it. It's a tragic part of it, but that they should not be defined by their last act.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Is the period of a full book.
Yeah, absolutely. As we alluded to suicide grief, why do you believe it is different from other types of loss due to death? What makes that, Dr. Pat, very unique?
So when we talk about suicide grief, and there are other griefs that would kind of go together or have some similarities, but specifically on suicide grief, the hallmark is that one is the lingering thoughts, is a movie in your head about the last days, what happened, which then brings the what ifs, which then brings what should I have done differently. And a big thing about suicide grief is guilt or blaming, because we are rational beings. And as we're trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together, we're missing a couple pieces. And as rational beings, we want to understand things. So we rationalize it by internalizing it and saying, it's my fault, or assigning blame.
Yes.
And so outside even of that, of focusing so much on that movie that doesn't stop, the what ifs, the intrusive thoughts, the blame and the guilt, we also have stigma, the taboo related to suicide. And when I was doing my dissertation on it, I I created two terms, and I call intrafamilial and extrafamilial facade, because I've seen it. So extrafamilial facade is when I am fearful or ashamed or any feel like scared of judgment. And so I put up a facade and I will say that the death was due to a heart attack or it was due to anything else but suicide. But when I put on that facade, which brings to a sanctioned way, like cause of death, then my bereavement that I show has to match that cause of death, right? Which is not necessarily what I am experiencing. Now, intrafamilial facade is when I choose family members that will know and those that will not know. And sometimes, like, we want to prevent the children or certain individuals from knowing because we're scared. We don't know how to share. We're scared of the chain event. We're scared of how they're going to react. So again, their grief and my grief will be different. And intrafamilial and extrafamilial facade can happen at the same time. They can happen at different times. But it just compounds the grief that we're already experiencing.
Yes, and from my experience, you know, with sitting with individuals who have experienced the loss of a family member due to suicide, it is very stigmatized. Many times, cause of death won't even be listed in an obituary. And I think the suicide statistics could be also underreported. I know with college students, I think suicide is like the second or third leading cause of death among college students, with I think the most vulnerable being the second semester of their freshman year. But actually, Dr. Pat, it could be the first cause of death, because a lot of individuals, because of the shame and stigma associated, family members won't report cause of death of suicide.
Yeah, that is so true. It is. There is a lot of either because, one, sometimes we cannot know. Two, because there is a stigma, so it becomes underreported. And I remember once when there was a suicide and I was asked to go to this school. Now, I was not acting in the, like, there were other counselors there whom I know and highly revered, but they were employed by the state or there. So there were things that they could or could not say, but not me. I was asked to go just because of my area of expertise by a former supervisor. And I remember as I'm there, I think the principal of the school not knowing what to do. And we were having a meeting with the staff and the teachers were saying, hey, they were asking about the suicide. And the principal's response was, we don't say that. Right? It's a hush, hush. We don't talk about it. It was like that person's choice, like that, the terms that were being used. And when we try to shroud something, hiding it doesn't make it go away.
No,
it actually piques curiosity. But it really talks about that stigmatization versus being able to talk about it. Like when I do my confidentiality agreement and when I teach my right as a clinical supervisor, my supervisees or my students, and we say part of confidentiality, if there's reason to believe that you want to harm or kill yourself or someone else, I go insofar as to say, if you're having thoughts of suicide, if you're driving and you're thinking, oh my God, if I got in a car accident, all my troubles will go away. There's so many people in that boat with you. This is such an actually common thought because like we get overwhelmed by things. This is where we talk about it. The only times that I will take action, call your emergency contact and do what we need to do to keep ourselves safe and protected is if there is an intent. If there are means, if there is a plan, yeah. Right? But when we don't talk about our ideation or our thoughts, they get more and more compounded. They get bigger. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to let you ask questions because I can talk about this forever.
Well, no, you continue because you're answering some of the questions I already have just through your responses. So we're good. So just keep going until there's a natural pause, and then I'll ask a question. So,
fair enough. When suicide grief, I wrote on a couple years back on some like do's and don'ts and things like that. And when we're talking about suicide, One is people become very scared of saying the person's name, mm-hmm. right? Because I'm going to trigger you to cry and I'm going to make you think about them. We're thinking about them.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Depending on, like, my friend, when he took his life, I thought about it, like, a lot. And I'm like, I used to work at the 1-800-SUICIDE. He slept on my couch to take care of my mom's dog that would stay with me. And I didn't see anything because I couldn't see anything. We're too close for comfort to see things. Mm-hmm. So when we're going through those movies, because we think we missed something and we are torturing ourselves, that's kind of like a distraction from the pain itself because it hurts so much and I can't fathom it. So I need to understand it. And knowing that I don't know is so different. Letting go of that becomes really important. One of the ways that I've identified to help with letting go is one, asking the question, what purpose does it serve me? When I created this coping strategy that I call memory in the pocket. Memory in the pocket is our mind will involuntarily start thinking the intrusive thoughts going through the movie. And I had a survivor of suicide when I first started facilitating groups. I facilitated groups for suicide loss for about 10 years. And she said, my grandma taught me this. When you start downloading, you know, the little bowl, the little circle that does this. So when the circle begins, the intrusive, involuntary thoughts, when they begin, you can't control them beginning, but you can control how they end. So the memory in the pocket is identifying a memory of that person, of how I want to remember them. This started when I lost my uncle. And when he passed, we were getting bits and pieces of information. And of course, in my mind, the narrative of it was awful. Whether or not it's actually what happened, I don't know. But my mind created an awful scenario. And when I would start that loop, it was painful. It was intense. So my memory in the pocket was he was a bachelor. He was like, I remember him when I was young with this slick black hair and the black glasses and like the button up, like royal blue shirt. I'm talking about like the 80s and 90s. But that's the image that I wanted to have of him and not the image that was in my mind that my thoughts were bringing. So that's how I would close the loop.
And you know, there are two things that struck me. One is the nostalgia piece is that we want to remember the best parts of who that individual was and is. You know, we want to remember their essence. We want to remember their pure spirit, their pure traits, what good they left in the world as opposed to the negativity that was associated with cause of death. The second thing, saying the name of your loved one is such a powerful tool because in my own experience with my losses and particularly, you know, with my daughter's transition, a lot of people would be afraid to say her name. And I would just say, look, saying my daughter's name is the greatest gift that you can give me because it tells me you remember. And if you think it's going to bother me, trust me, I'm already bothered. I'm thinking about her all the time. So the fact that you can share her name, we can share a memory, and you talk about that memory packet that you created with your relative, we can create a memory packet that's full of some really, really good memories of the times that we shared singularly and together and, you know, create a positive alternative memory to all the negative types of thoughts that come into our head with the what ifs and all the other questions that haunt us.
And we create, it's kind of going very Pavlovian here, but we want to create this connection that when I think of a negative, it's followed by a positive, right? I'm creating that association and I'm having to actively do it. That's the thing. The intrusive thoughts, they're not an active thing. They just come. And so we need to put effort. And one of the bereavement, in spite of cause, right? I'm not differentiating between complicated and uncomplicated, disenfranchised cause of death or regular cause of death. I am just saying bereavement. We go through a depressive state. Because if you think of mood as energy, the present that existed no longer exists. And the energy that we had, or the things that were like, there's something that has been removed from our normal. So it takes us a minute to reconcile that depletion. And during that time, we don't want to do anything. We have existential thinking. We have no motivation. We don't want to see anyone. We're more easily irritable, right? All of those things will happen. So I think it becomes really important for us to be aware of that, because we're not going to feel like ourselves. Another thing about suicide grief that's different from uncomplicated grief by a sanctioned reason or cause of death is longevity, right? The first year, the tendency, and this is an observation that I've had, more of an empirical thing. What I notice is the first year is surreal. You can't believe, like, it cannot have happened. How? Like, why? What? I'm existing. The second year is a different pain, because now it's real. But now it's a reality that I don't want to accept. The third year is when I start to adjust to this new reality, right? So it's not that 6 months, 3 months feel like it takes time. So for everyone else, life's continuous. But for a person going through it, there's these two parallel lives, the life that everybody's going through. And I am stepping into this one, and it feels like it was just yesterday. And this one, and it feels like it was just yesterday.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, and that's why the stages of grief doesn't apply to grief related to death, or for any other loss, even not related to death, because grief is not linear. It's very circular. And you're right. The first year, it's very surreal. It's like, for me, I expected my daughter to just come into the kitchen and say, "Dad, just kidding. We're going to give you your life back." And then when I hit 1 year and 1 day, not only did the surrealness wear off, but the emptiness that accompanied the pain of the reality that I was facing was that she wasn't coming back, made the second year worse than the first year. The stage theory doesn't cut it. The year time frame doesn't cut it. That we're done in a year, we put our grief in a little box, and then we move on as if life is normal again, doesn't apply, because life has permanently changed whenever her loved one physically leaves this planet.
Yeah. I think it's really important to bring awareness to this time, because I've had so many people that a year go by and they're like, why? Like, what's wrong with me? Why can't? And I'm like, no. Like, there is, at least what we've noticed, a 3 year, and it's not a cookie cutter thing. No. Some people will take longer. Some people will take less time. It depends on getting support for this.
Yes.
What am I doing? And am I allowing people in? That really does change our experience of that.
Yeah. And I think as long as there is movement from the raw pain of loss to making a decision to re-engage in life again with purpose, time is relative. As long as there is progress, as long as there is movement and there is support for that movement, people are different. Dr. Pat, there's individual differences. That's why I took a course in undergraduate on individual differences. We're going to progress at our own pace. But as long as we're progressing, as long as we're moving towards re-engaging in life again, time is relative.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Another thing that I would say, so we talked about like saying the person's name. It gives me the ability to talk about it.
Yes.
Crying is not a bad thing, right? I remember growing up in my grandma's funeral, or both grandmas, I would see people consoling each other by saying, "Don't cry." So I never paid attention to the words themselves, but I just thought, oh, that's what you say to console someone. Until the day that I decided to actually pay attention to the words, I'm like, oh my God, why am I telling you not to cry? Like, this is the way that you liberate your emotions, your set. It's going to come out somehow. If you hold it in, the great book, Your Body Keeps the Score.
Yes.
It's going to stay there somewhere. So you want to let it out. So being able to allow the person to cry, I know that that's part of the process. And if you're uncomfortable with it, you don't have to stay, but not to tell the person not to do it. There's something else that I was going to say that came to my mind, but then immediately left. So I'll come back to it when it comes back.
That sounds good. And I've done that before myself too. So I'll just say something and then I'll remember it 5 or 10 minutes later. So how do we create safe spaces for survivors of suicide loss to share their stories and their challenges?
Oh, beautiful question. I think it's coming from a place of caring and support, not asking the contact questions, how did it happen? What did he or she or they used to do it, right? It, not being curious about the scene, but being curious about the process questions. How are you doing? It's nice to see you. And actually mean it. If I'm going to ask you, how are you doing? Actually mean it. When I did the Survivor of Suicide Loss group, we talked about, like, I hate when people ask me, how am I doing? I am doing really bad. But you can't really say that, right? That so one of the, there was this couple that they came up with, and we all started using the, in telling their employees, when I come back, just say, it's nice to see you. As opposed to ask, how are you doing? Or the question, how many kids do you have when you've lost a kid? Mm-hmm. That was like, so we've talked about, like, not everybody needs to know the cause of death. Yep. But I think part of creating the support is being there for the person, not for your curiosity, but because I really want to just show that you have support if and when you're ready to talk. Being help by coming and, like, we talk about bringing food or bringing the essentials, because in this moment, I'm not taking care of myself.
Yeah.
I'm not taking care of, like, thinking about the administrative stuff that I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
No, the dual process model of grief, right, says that we can either have the emotional aspect of grief or the restorative, the administrative aspects of grief. We cannot do them at the same time.
Yep.
So if I have somebody who is able to, like, I got you, I got your kids from school, we can drop them off, we can, like, we have a rotation, take your time. Unless I'm saying, hey, I need to do the admin because I am going insane mm-hmm. in my house on my own. But we may not know what we need. Maybe give us options of what you can offer.
Yeah, I think, and that's the time to be directive, because in early grief, people may not know what they need. They're experiencing brain fog, difficulty concentrating, doing the practical tasks of organization, so we can help them with that. And I think the other thing is, and one of the reasons I asked that question is, if we're not careful, these are individual survivors of suicide loss who are going to feel more isolated than usual because of the stigma associated with the death. The questions that they're probably already getting, like you said, the content questions, you know, I've had some individual survivors of suicide loss, and they've been asked, did you see the signs? Or even, did you contribute? Do you think you contributed to that person completing suicide? Which is the worst thing you can say to somebody who's a survivor of suicide, because they're feeling guilty enough as it is.
So, yes.
So they're going to feel more isolated than usual. And as clinicians and as coaches, we need to break that isolation, lessen the gap by, like you said, asking the process questions, seeing what we can do to meet an immediate need, and also focusing on the stories of the individuals that they've lost rather than focus on the cause of death.
Yeah. Yeah. And no speculation.
Yeah.
Stop with speculations, right? Sometimes it was, there's so many reasons, so many things that we still don't know as to the cause of suicide grief. I remember when I worked at the 1-800-SUICIDE, and there were people that at that moment, the way that I kind of describe it is you kind of get in a trance when you just need to escape that state. And so, like, your world is like this. If you put your hand over your eyes completely, all you see is darkness and you can't get out of it. And it's this urgency, I need to get out of this and I don't know how. And in the conversations in the 1-800-SUICIDE, I would help them just kind of do this and go further and further. So you can see, like, okay, there are options, right? But if in the moment, if I am in a space that I can't do this and I'm just here, I may not have complete faculty of what I just need to get out of it. I had a survivor of suicide, she had lost her child, and she would, the analogy that she would use was as if her kid was in the Twin Towers.
Yep.
And decided to jump as opposed to die because it was going to collapse on itself. It's like, I am just, I have the opportunity, not the opportunity, but I have the ability to end it myself, as opposed to have it be and to end me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we live on our own terms and we die on our own terms. And I've learned that. I've learned that. It's free will. It's the free will to decide either way.
Yeah.
And particularly when you look at medically assisted death or aid in dying legislation, you know, that's a free will to determine how we want to exit this world. Do we want to exit it with more pain and suffering, or do we want to spare our loved ones additional pain and suffering if there's no other additional treatment options? But those are just some of the questions I think that we grapple with. What are some things you should not say to a survivor of suicide loss? What are some things that you would not recommend saying that would not be comforting?
You didn't see it coming? What did you miss? I hate that. Like, somebody asked me once that, and I was like, How did they do it? But you had the gun at the house. Why'd you get that gun? Right? Like, were you not checking? What were the signs? I'm like, we don't know. Right? We don't see it. We, as you said before, we're already blaming ourselves. All of those questions do not help. Those are questions to meet your curiosity, not to help the person.
Yep. Exactly. And yeah, those type of questions are not helpful. It just isn't. And if anything, it undermines the grief of the survivors, and it undermines the life of that individual who took their lives.
Oh, absolutely. Were they on drugs?
Yeah.
Were they depressed? Like, there's so many speculations. And it, as I said, I think at the beginning, suicide doesn't discriminate.
No.
Some people will have passive suicidal ideation where it's a thought that's in their mind. It's sometimes a way to be able to choose to live is knowing that I can take my life. Some people will have active suicidal ideation. A person who's had passive suicidal ideation can at some point have an active one, but it can be because a person struggles with depression or mental health, struggles with substance use or not. Yeah. Or a person that seems to have it all and be okay, but there's so many unknowns that speculations are just that. Like, we can say that one of the things that you see in research, when a person struggles with depression, it can heighten the possibility or the likelihood. A person struggling with those are factors that can increase the chances. But it does not mean that without those, there are no chances, because as we see, there are.
Yes, absolutely. What practical strategies do you share that can help survivors deal with the challenges of suicide loss?
So one is the cognitive balance, meaning we talked about the memory in the pocket. The cognitive balance is you think that you're, when you notice you're focusing so much on the what ifs, on all like what we are creating a parallel universe that we don't know if the outcome would be different. So when you're thinking about what I should have done or could have done, try not to shoot on yourself, right? Think about all the things that you did do, right? Those are actually real. What are the things that we did do? If I'm going to judge myself, judge yourself from this, from the knowledge that your past self had. Now, looking back, I can see so many things, right, that now make sense and add on. But that individual didn't. When we talk about hindsight bias, is that, right? I cannot judge the actions that I took in the past with the knowledge that I have in the future or in my present, her future. I need to judge based on her own knowledge, let people in, right? Let people help, seek assistance. The groups for suicide loss become so imperative. There's something to be said about normalization. I used to say when I would see, and it was such a beautiful connection, I say that with suicide grief, sometimes you feel like you're naked in a world where everyone is fully clothed. And you feel vulnerable because you don't know who is a survivor of suicide or who isn't. People don't have it stamped on them. But there are so many survivors of suicide out there. Like, if we estimate, I don't know what the current statistics on it, but I think it was a couple of years back, it was like 46,000. This was like pre-COVID. So now imagine even more. For every death, we estimate at least 6 survivors of suicide. And if it's 46, let's say, every year, it's an accumulation of survivors of suicide. So we're in the millions out there. But no one goes to a bar and is like, hey, I'm a survivor of suicide. Anyone else? But I'm sure that we're all in good company. Mm-hmm. When I would see people going to groups, it was just something to know that, oh my God, everyone here is naked with me. We're emotionally raw. And that normalization is, you are feeling what I feel. And I would hear so much like, I don't need to hear someone else's sob story. The normalization piece is so important. We go back to Adler, and he would talk about a person feeling the need to belong in a society. When, I'm going to go somewhere very different, but I promise there's a point to it. When a mother becomes a mother for the first time, none of her friends are mothers. She will start going to Mommy and Me classes, and she needs to find her community, not to discard the other community that she has, but she needs to find somebody that has commonalities with her. When we talk about AA, there's this commonality, this power in numbers. It's similar. You're entering a new community that none of us wanted to be part of, but unfortunately we are. And knowing that we're not alone is huge. So joining a support group becomes really important. Finding your individual therapist, yes, I can have a bias, of course, because that's what I do. But it's a guide. I will not push a button that will magically make you feel better. But we are in a tunnel of darkness. You don't know how to reach the light. I don't know your tunnel, but I've been through many, and I'm happy to be there with you to guide you through it. You don't have to do it alone, right? And being able to accept that can be very helpful. So memory in the pocket, cognitive balance, and accepting help, groups, individual therapy.
Yeah, I think a combination of a powerful support group, a very individual therapist that's willing to be a co-companion on the path to transformation, and they're walking the path with that person and not for them, I think that combination can help individuals transcend grief, transform grief, integrate grief, and reestablish themselves in the world with meaning again.
And I just want to add one thing. In a family, we can grieve differently.
Yes.
Sometimes one person may take that, we talked about the dual process models, and take the admin while everyone is taking the emotional, and they might be like numb in that moment, taking care of everyone else. And then 2-3 months down the line, I fall into that emotional state. So our grief does not have the same timeline. And we may, in general, based on cultural differences, gender, sexual orientation, all of that influence the way past experience with grief may influence the way that we grieve. So it may not look similar. And I think it becomes important for us to know how to grieve individually and how to grieve together.
Yeah. And also how to understand the unique differences that we have in grief, especially with couples, and to be able to hold space for that, understand it, and support it. I think that also strengthens a relationship because, you know, many times when there's traumatic loss, relationships are strained. Relationships may break up. But I think if there's a good foundation for a relationship, there's been communication, there's been love, I think they can transcend, and those relationships can become stronger after traumatic loss.
I will kind of jump into even my use of the IAP, the intention, action, perception, in that, because sometimes, let's say that I lost someone and I am crying and I see that my partner doesn't shed a tear. My interpretation of the lack of tears can be, you don't care. How can you not care? We just lost this person. What do you mean? Right? Because it's my interpretation. For me, tears equals feelings. That person may be internally crying, but externally being either stoic or strong because that's their way of processing it. Yep. Right. So my perception of someone else's behavior is not the only possibility. And I bring that awareness a lot when I'm working with families or I'm working with couples who go through that, because again, grief can present in different ways. Some people laugh out of nervousness instead of crying, right? So be able to understand the intentionality behind it. I don't want to cry because if I cry, I don't think I'll be able to control myself, right? I cry in private, but no one knows. I don't want anyone to know. Yep. So that's how I bring the IAP into grief.
And that's also the IAP model. For those that don't know what IAP stands for, if you could just let them know what the three components of that model are. And I know that dovetails with your book, Why Are We Fighting?
Yes. So the IAP model, it stands for intention, action, perception. Here's my book. Why are we fighting? Actionable strategies for effective communication. And as you saw, my name is gigantic. He went through it before, but like, yes. Hence the Dr. T, Dr. Pat, because it made just life easier for everyone else. But essentially, I've determined or I've observed and experienced, right? Because it's from empirical, either in observing in the field, as well as my own experiences in friendships, relationships, that intention is internal. Only I know my intentions. Perception is also internal, but is internal to the receiver or observer of the action. The only external factor is the action itself. And an action can be verbal, my tone of voice, the words that I use can be nonverbal, the roll of the eyes, or anything that I do. But the thing about the action is that all actions do not have a universal meaning. When I think about something and I act upon it, I have a difficult time understanding that somebody else would perceive it completely different. And that's when miscommunications come about. So the example of the me not crying, equaling, I may perceive that as you don't care. As opposed to me not crying is I care so much about you that I want to be your rock. So I am swallowing my feelings to make sure that we're okay.
And I can see how your model could work very effectively, particularly with couples who have misperceptions about how each other are grieving, and particularly in early grief, they may not have the energy to deal with their own grief, much less each other's. So with everything complicated with the guilt and the shame, that can tend to really cloud perception about how the other person is grieving. So providing that model, I could see, could clear up a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of misperception about how individuals grieve.
Yeah, I think one of the goals when it comes to the IAP model, and I call it the Google Translate of communication, because in session, I'm legitimately a Google Translate. I always give this example. I thought it was so funny. And recently it happened again, but I would just give this, which is an older example, when I had this couple in front of me. It was a heterosexual couple. The wife was American of a Latino descent. The husband was Latino who moved to the U.S., right? So this gives you a context of the different, even though the countries were the same, there is a difference in how you grew up, how you were raised, and culturally speaking. And in session, he said the statement, this is a sacrifice I'm willing to make. Now, to him, this is a sacrifice I'm willing to make was a positive statement. But the word sacrifice is what she really focused on. And what she took was, this is an investment, not a sacrifice, because sacrifice to her had a negative connotation. And it's funny because like I saw it coming out of one person's mouth and taking a turn as it went into the other person's, just like the mannerisms, right? And so in such, I'm able to pause and be like, wait, what did you mean by this? How did you receive this? Which is really cool when I get to do that. But the goal is for you to be able to do that yourself. So it's to curb assumptions. So seek clarification before going with the assumption.
Yep.
Essentially.
Yep. Makes sense. It also is a nice model to promote using active listening skills.
You said it.
Yep.
It's very true. I talk. There are strategies that I developed, right, mm-hmm. that are but there are also strategies that exist that became important.
Yep.
Reflecting is one of them. It's not a strategy that I developed, but I definitely talk about it in the book. Mm-hmm. And because there's a science to reflecting. Yep. I hear you. I repeat back to you what you said, what I understood from what you said, and I give you the opportunity to tell me if I'm right or wrong.
Absolutely. If we present every reflection as an observation, and that is absolute truth, individuals have the option to either accept the observation, accept part of the observation, or reject it.
Yeah. I did this exercise once, and just because I was speaking to a person whom I love in my family, but who's like our conversation were about different political ideologies. Right? You know, we're talking about politics. Everybody wants to be heard. So I've expressed, like, I'm going to listen to your point of view and the analogy that you're using. I'm going to repeat back to you. So I did the whole reflecting, right? And then once he was done with his argument and he said that I clearly understood the argument, I'm like, okay, let me now say my piece and I'll ask you to do the same for me to reflect back. Please know, like, I'm a therapist. I know the whole concept of reflecting, like, it's his first time doing it, right? So like I can't add like, but mm-hmm. I explained it. When I presented my argument and he was going to rebut it, and before I said, can you please just repeat back to me what you heard? He repeated to me what he thought I was going to say and not actually what I said. And the cool thing is that the other family member that was there with us said, oh my God, no, that's not what she said at all. Because sometimes we're so sure that we know what you're going to say that we're actually not paying attention.
That's right. And we assume based on past experiences with other individuals that may cloud our perception in the current situation, our own belief system, which leads can lead to inaccurate assumptions when we're dealing with individuals who are coming from different perspectives. So all of that internal noise and can really contribute to a lot of misunderstanding.
Yeah. One of the examples that I use in the book is if I've never been cheated on before and my partner picks up a call and goes to a different room, I may not notice, or I may notice and not pay mind to it and just think, oh, the signal here must have been better. It's likely something from work. However, if I've been cheated on before, either by this individual or a previous individual, my partner picks up a phone call and goes to the next room, suspicious.
Yeah.
Right? Because now there's a meaning associated to that behavior from a previous experience. And mm-hmm. another thing that I love about the IAP model is, one, it asks us, if I'm going to pause my assumptions, I need to understand what my assumptions are and where they come from and be able to communicate. Because if I then communicate to this partner, if I am not aware and I'm thinking that your action is suspicious, now I need you to prove me a negative, to prove me that you're not cheating on me, right? Yep. Which can become a little bit difficult, but I can show you. But if I'm able if I become self-aware and I express, hey, because of past experiences, when I notice that whenever you take a call to a different room, it triggers me. Mm-hmm. So before doing so, can you just let me know, hey, I'm going to go to the next room because this is a important work call or the signal really sucks here. If you let me know, my mind is not seeking to put it to fill in the blanks.
Yeah. And it's also building the foundation for a trusting, open and transparent relationship too when we do that.
Yeah. But again, the concept of self-awareness comes in because we once, and I'm making a generalization here, I'm very aware of the statement I'm going to make, but sometimes we believe that the meaning associated to a behavior is unequivocal.
Yep.
There's no other possibility but, which is not always the case. There have been so many things, like I have one of my best friends and I, we see the world so differently that sometimes her interpretation of my behaviors, I couldn't even fathom, and vice versa. Quick example, she and I were talking about the concept of respect. Now, I grew up, my parents were divorced. My sister, who's 5 years older, kind of like raised us, essentially. So we were very direct with each other. We didn't have those nuances of the diplomacy. We just we say what we mean to say. And I learned growing up that you always tell the truth. If you cooked for me, for example, it would be disrespectful for me to say that I liked what you made me if I didn't. Right? I don't get to choose when I say what is true to me and what isn't true to me. I need to say it to you, because not is disrespectful. As my friend and I were talking, she's like, growing up, I learned that it is disrespectful to be rude. So telling somebody who cooked something for me that I didn't like their food is rude, and that would be disrespectful. So even the concept of respect can be different. It doesn't have a universal meaning.
Yeah. And I think it's important for us to understand what the concept of respect means and meet the individual where they're at and try to help them come to understand the difference between respect, disrespect, and being honest as an extension of being respectful. The IAP model just sounds wonderful. It sounds like we could have another podcast discussion just about your book and how the IAP model applies to resolving conflict and improving the quality of our life, self-esteem, and our image of ourselves, and how it empowers us, maybe to establish some healthy boundaries as well, too. I could see all that going there, so.
Yes. Oh, I love it. Anytime. We can talk for hours.
I'm down for that. We'll have to do another follow-up down the road for sure, so. But I do have a couple of last questions for you. The first, Dr. Pat, if you're going to leave our listeners with just one ultimate takeaway today, what would that be?
When you're filling the blank for something, when you have your first assumption, pause and identify, are there other possibilities? Or possibly even ask, what was your intention? Right? The rule of three interpretations kind of asks us to do that, is pause and identify two alternative interpretations to your immediate one. That can help shift the initial reaction to a more thoughtful response.
Yep. It makes sense because, you know, one of the things I tell my students, if you're going to send an email that is emotionally charged, write the email, sit on it for 24 hours, go back to it and ask yourself, do I want to send the email as I originally wrote it? Because you'll find in 24 hours, your emotions will calm down. They will become more even keel, and you look at that and say, no, I don't really want to say that, because we can't take anything back that we say verbally in anger, and we sure as heck can't take anything back in writing that we say in anger. So it's be mindful, ask yourself, is this what I really want to say? Is this what I really want to do? Pause, and then take action.
Yeah. One of the coping strategies in the book is called the three columns of communication that helps exactly with that.
Perfect. Dr. Pat, my last question for you. If people want to get in touch with you, purchase your book, contract for you for your services, find out what you have to offer. What's the best way for them to do that?
You can find my book at Amazon, but just go to my link. It's www.advocate2create.com. So it's called Advocate to Create. I really believe in advocacy, and when we advocate for ourselves, we create our paths. Hence, advocate2create.com.
And I'll make sure all of your contact information and also your social media links too get in the episode notes when the podcast goes live. So with that, Dr. Pat, thank you so much for a wonderful conversation this evening. I enjoyed it immensely, and I look forward to doing it again in the future.
Thank you so much, Dave. I really appreciate you. I really enjoyed being here.
Thank you. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.